All right. So this episode, we're recording a little bit early this week, actually before the previous episode, because I'm going on vacation, Benjamin. You're sticking around for now. Yeah, but we don't want to miss a week. So if there's any crazy news that we missed, then, we'll address it, next week. But I think luckily, we avoided all the big stuff for the summer. So, maybe we'll see. But we do have some things that have been kind of hanging around in the show notes that we haven't gotten to yet that we want to kind of clear out before we get past the summertime. So, let's just jump in first up. Tell me about, your local HomeKit favorite.
Yeah. So I've been lamenting on the show for a while that although HomeKit, ecosystem is expanding, there's still very few UK specific accessories, and for some categories this isn't a problem, but for others it's directly incompatible. That I've used several smart plugs in the past, and the way I've done that is by using converters on the front and the back, which is not ideal, but you can get by. The biggest thing I've been coming up against is the lighting situation. Obviously the Philips Hue bulbs are the same size, E27 Edison screw, or that's worldwide. But what you really kind of want when you're doing HomeKit proper is the equivalent of what you have in the Lutron Kaseya stuff, which is the smart switches on the wall, so you can turn the lights off actually at the wall.
Right.
And have, whatever bulbs and stuff you want. And I've been kind of impatiently waiting for a long time. And finally, about the end of last year, this company called Lightwave launched. They did smart lights before, but they weren't HomeKit. So now they've rolled out a new hub and compatible lighting to do a HomeKit one. And so I just wanted to bring it up because I'm pretty happy with them. I did a full post on 95 Max. You can read that if you want. But basically, I did three lights. So trying to do, we have an open plan kitchen, living room, and dining area. So I kind of wanted to do that whole space, not just do one light by itself. So it's not every room in the house by any means, but it's one of the main areas. And, it's hard to weigh up. People who say, oh, is it worth it? Is it worth it? And these things are expensive. They're not cheap, but I wouldn't want to take them away. It's one of those first world luxuries that, the Apple Watch, you could live without it if you had to, but you don't not want to. And then you have lights that you can turn off when you're not at home, when you're outside and you can see you've left one on, or you're just sitting down and you want to turn all three of them off at once. It's funny how it creeps up on you and actually being useful. Because I've been messing around with some Hue bulbs in various places, but then you have the problem that if anybody comes around, you have to explain to them how you don't turn the switch off the wall, you have to use this other switch, or you use your voice, or whatever else. And it's just not very elegant. Actually having on the wall dimmable smart switches is just so much better. And even the switches themselves, before you even include any of the automation of the voice control stuff, these lights were dimmable before, but we had the analog dimmers, which are just a dial that you have to rotate. Some comments on my review complained that they look like elevator lights, elevator up down buttons.
Yeah,
kind of. But I actually kind of really like how they look. They're metal finish, and you can just click on them to turn them off or hold them down to adjust. And the big reason that UK people can't use the standard Lutron US lights is because our home wiring is different. The neutral wire is rare to find in a UK household behind the wall cavity. So you actually have to get different lights that only have one light in and one wire in and one wire out, which is luckily what these do. But that just means why I've been slow on the uptake here, because there just hasn't really been anything on the market. And even now, these are basically the only option for UK HomeKit integrated switches.
Yeah, Philips Hue, I recommend if you're not comfortable with changing out the wall light switch, especially if it's not a permanent place where you live, I guess. But the thing is, it's such a dance. I have to figure out Do you want to add a dimmer switch like in place of the one that you lose because you have to have the light on, and effectively you're just changing the brightness from 0 to 100 when you say on and off. And another thing that I ran into with Hugh is over the weekend we were away and in mid-afternoon, and we returned home before sunset, and all of the Hue lights were turned on when we got back home. And I noticed because the outside lights were all turned on, those are all Hue lights. And what it is when the power goes out and comes back on, the lamps or the lights resume at 100%. Like if you flick the switch on the wall to off and back on, it will turn the light on. So we pulled up and I said, oh, the power must have gone out because all the lights are turned on, all the Hue ones. And sure enough, if you look at the microwave and the stove clocks and they're flashing, and it's like, that's kind of inconvenient. That doesn't really happen. It doesn't happen with the Lutron wall switches for whatever reason. So, I guess because it's wired and not, you know, however it's set up with Hue.
Because the switches basically have a little memory chip in them to remember the brightness levels and stuff.
Yeah. So it's more effort up front, but it's a lot more elegant. And then the only thing is that whenever you – like with the situation with the wall switch is you've got to figure out what kind of bulb you want to use. And like the old-fashioned bulbs in the U.S. work great with dimming. But newer bulbs, you've got to make sure that they're dimmable. And then only certain ones at that point are compatible. Some – make a humming sound that are incompatible. So it's not quite as straightforward at all as Hue to set up, but once you've got it figured out, like when I did the review of Lutron, the wall switches a while ago, and I found a specific like strand of Sylvania bulbs that worked fine and had no issue with, but those are the challenges. But then as long as you're not like moving every year, I think it's worth it to go that route. Especially if you're like building a home or buying your own home and not like renting a house or an apartment or something, and you're going to be there for a while, then it's worth it up front for sure. And in terms of like benefits, you know, when I first moved in the house I live in now, it's a larger house than my last home. And the power bill like kind of frightened me up front. And, it's like, oh, it's just a lot more rooms, and big part of it is like more house to heat and cool, and that's a big deal. But also like lights being left on. The bulb type was the old bulb type, and those are not energy efficient at all. And having a house full of those, I noticed a major power bill change, like a decrease changing out to modern light bulbs. And it was a mixture of Hue and then with Sylvania or with Lutron, the Sylvania bulbs that are newer. And they run cooler too. Like in the bathroom, we've got there's a vanity light set up. It's like maybe like 10 bulbs, and there are those. I don't know what they're called. It's been a while since I did work on this, but they get really hot, and it's like those cannot be energy efficient. Like it's almost like a little heater when they're turned on.
They're the halogen ones.
Yeah. So we've got one. Lutron wall switch to turn those on, like all of them, because it would be one light switch. So versus replacing all of the bulbs, and that's nice. And the last thing about that is that the wall switch is in the bathroom, so you would need to go into the bathroom to the corner of it to turn it on for those lights. And there are two other lights that you get to before that, but if you only want to use those, then you need to go into the bathroom to get to it. And so with Lutron, they give you a little, they call it a Pico remote, and you can mount it to the wall. And then I put that at like the front of the bathroom so you can turn on the light as you enter it versus like being in the bathroom. So it's nice. So yeah, I mean, if you're doing a HomeKit home, especially if you're like building a house or you own your own home and you're not going to be moving every year or every couple of years, it's so worth it to go the light switch route. And it's cool that that UK has some options now. I do agree that they're like elevators.
Do you do any like automations with the light? Do you have them turn on automatically, turn off, that type of stuff?
The only thing I do is at sunset local turn on, and then at 10 p.m. turn off. You can do sunrise turn off too, but I don't need the lights to be. These are outside lights. So there's a front porch light, a parking garage area light, and all the backyard lights, and they're all in a zone called outside. and those all turn on automatically at night and then off later in the evening, so that I'm never like I look at my neighbor's house and they've got, you know, it's like 9 a.m., 10 a.m. and the sun's been out for a while and their lights are still on outside, and I just want to like turn them off so bad. That's the only thing I do, but I don't do anything inside. Like, one thing you could do is with like a presence sensor, if presence is not detected, to turn off the light at, you know, I think that would be useful, especially and on my house, my bedroom fan gets left on all the time when no one's in there, and that those halogen lights, the bathroom lights, get left on, and those I know use a lot of energy. So the fan and those lights, and I could set up an automation that turns it off if motion is not detected, but then you run the risk of being in the room and motion isn't detected, and you get the lights turned off on you. It's like
that's the problem I've like run up against, is that the idea of it like sounds great, but then there's a lot of edge cases that the current like HomeKit automation system can't really do very well. Like, what if someone comes around that isn't on your home, and they're just in that room for a while, and you're in a different room, and then, you know, they're technically home, but the presence isn't going to include that person. You could have a motion sensor, and if you just sit still for too long, you might accidentally turn the lights off on you. Or if you have it like turn on the light when you come in, it might be in the middle of the day and you don't really want the lights on that time. Like, it's hard to like, there's a lot of like fuzzy logic that goes into the question of, do you actually want the lights on this time? So for now, I've been pretty restrained on like the automations I have. Like, I only really have one that at 2 a.m. at night, it just turns all the lights off because we're generally all asleep by then.
So in case it's left on, then it turns it off.
In case it's left on, we don't want them left on all night, so they just turn themselves off.
That's smart.
Which is useful, but that's like the extent of the automation that can kind of fit with the, you know, these are the main rooms. So if the lights start going wacky as you come in and come out, it's going to be, you know, very annoying. Like, when you have like a garage, it kind of makes sense to just have that on a motion sensor and it can just stay on for half an hour and then turn itself off. But if you've got like the heavily trafficked areas, like the dining room, like, you might just be walking straight out to the garden. You don't really want to leave the lights on for 20 minutes if you're walking straight through it. So there's definitely, we're still definitely in like the early stages of the smart home automation stuff in general. And yeah, I always keep thinking of those rumors of the, like, before the HomePod came out, the idea of the HomePod with a camera in it.
Yeah.
And, like, it could see, oh, you're definitely in the room. There's somebody definitely here. Like, it's not just work. Because all the presence sensors are, like, infrared movement. Like, ideally, you'd have, like, a HomePod with a camera that could face recognize the people in it. And there's such a massive rabbit hole that you could possibly go down. But for now, I just like the benefits of occasionally being able to turn it on with my voice. It's good to check the lights when you leave, and like you get down the road and like, did I turn the lights off? I can just check it on my phone. And then the one kind of like scene that I have is at nighttime in the living room where the TV is. I have like a nighttime TV scene that just turns off all of the lights apart from one to like a low brightness, like a 25% brightness every single day.
Yeah.
And the convenience of that adds up, because normally you'd have to go around, turn off all three lights, then, you know, adjust the one that you want if you want it to be a bit dimmer. Whereas now you say one command and it turns two off and sets one down. It's like, you know, this is the kind of futuristic stuff that actually, you know, makes a difference. But yeah, it's not cheap to do.
Yeah, the presence sensor that I use, the motion sensor that I use, mostly is because I've got the Ecobee thermostat that works with HomeKit. Ecobee 3 Lite, or 4, they all work with HomeKit. You can also, they come with presence sensors, and you can buy more to expand. And the idea of that is that the system, like if you're in the living room and the system knows that you're not in the bedroom, and the living room is the ideal temperature that you've got it set at, and the bedroom is cooler or hotter, like not the target, it'll say, okay, I don't need to work harder because no one's there. So, you know, even though the house can be different temperatures, like say a window or a fire, you know, place, something is changing the temperature, it doesn't need to worry about it if you're not there. And so I've got the sensors for that reason, but they also show up in HomeKit, and then they're exposed as sensors that you can use with lights. Like, so you can use those same Ecobee presence sensors that are mainly for temperature and to know, you know, if you're in the room or not, to also work with automations for lights and stuff like that. I've also got one of the Philips Hue motion sensors just to try it out, and that gives you a lot more data, like what is the brightness in the room right now. So if you're like, you know, want to base it on like sunlight or I guess that'd be the main thing. I think it also shows you temperature, but it's a lot bulkier and it's just like a different form factor. In terms of like scenes, so in automation, I do have a scene, one of the default ones they recommend, I'm leaving, and that will turn off all the lights except for the outside lights because they're on their own schedule. But it's so nice to be able to say, I'm leaving, and every, you know, HomeKit light in the house turns off without you needing to go and like flip all the switches or like check the kids' room and see if they left their light on, check the bathrooms, you know, that kind of thing. It's just, you're gone, all the lights are gone. You can automate that. And if everyone in the house like has an iPhone, or your kids don't, but they're always going to be with a parent, then you can pretty reliably automate that to say, like, if you're gone, like when you leave, to turn that on. And I've got mine set to also close the garage. And you can say when the last person leaves to run that scene. So like if it's always mom and dad, mom's still there, but dad leaves, nothing happens. But then if mom and dad are gone, then the scene will run automatically. You know, and the idea is like you do it a few times and you start to trust it and you're like, okay, it works. Good. And if you're in a situation where there's never someone there without a device that's part of your HomeKit setup, then you can do it. And then in that situation, then it's like, well, what if someone is there? Well, then you just toggle off the automation, you know, for the period while you have family over or a babysitter or something. But in that case, like it's pretty ideal. But I don't do it automatically. I just say like, I tell Siri on the watch or the phone, I'm leaving. And then yeah. I just remember to do it. And at times I don't remember to do it, I kind of kick myself because I come home and like, oh, the fan's still on and this light was on the whole time. I feel like that was wasted. But I've not gotten to the point where I trusted, even though I could do when every person leaves, you know, the last person leaves. That's part of it now. It wasn't originally, but they've added that in since the HomeKit started. So it's come a long way. And I could do a whole podcast on HomeKit stuff, and let's move on to some of our other topics for this episode. iPad, we talked a few weeks ago about the 11-inch iPad Pro rumor and the 12.9-inch iPad Pro rumor, where the bezel gets slimmed down a whole lot to look kind of like the iPhone 10. And the idea that we discussed kind of before the show that didn't really make it because of time is, will the screen be rounded like the iPhone 10? Will it have a home indicator like the iPhone 10, since that there is no home button based on the rumor? And I think my first guess would have been yes, rounded screen, no home indicator. And but you varied on that a little bit. So you start.
Yeah. So obviously iOS 12 mirrors the iPhone 10's gestures onto the iPad as much as it can. And the way it works on the iPad is there's no indicator at the moment, so you just have to do an edge. You have to go off the edge of the screen to start. The thing with the phone is, part of the reason the indicator is there is that it provides a little bit of buffer, because there's so little bezel on the phone, you need like that designated area of the screen that can just be like the gesture area, essentially. Even if it's got like background coloring content, the idea is there's nothing interactable there, so a swipe can never get cancelled out by something else. So on the phone, it's more the home indicator kind of does something that the iPad doesn't need. Because if you assume the iPad bezels are going to get slimmed down, I think it's fair to say they're probably not going to get slimmed down to the point of what the iPhone 10 is like, where it's, you know, a 3mm bezel on the top and bottom. It's probably going to be, you know, more like, even if you take the slimmest bezels that are available on the iPad today, the side bezels on the 10.5-inch, they're 8mm. And that difference in space gives you enough room for your finger to be able to reliably swipe up from the bottom of the screen. Like, you're not starting in midair. You can just start on that tiny sliver of plastic in that tiny gap.
And because so the iPad screen's bigger, that bezel, even though it's bigger, it still looks really thin.
Yeah, it's still going to be relatively small. It's
proportional.
Like the 10.5-inch iPad is pretty impressive on the sides. It's just you still have the same height on the top and the bottom at the moment, because you've got the home button there, and they're just bigger. Like, an iPad that has those side bezels on the top and the bottom as well would look pretty impressive, especially yeah. as you then go up to 12.9 inches and do it there as well, because then you're even getting more of a relative change
yeah.
in screen size and bezel size. Also, if you think of the way the home indicator works, it basically nullifies everything to the left of it and everything to the right of it, because you're just basically making this kind of transparent toolbar at the bottom that can have nothing else in it apart from this indicator, essentially. You can't put buttons on the same horizontal plane as it, because, you know, they just can't be used. And if you imagine what they would look like on an iPad, because the iPad screen is bigger, you end up with a lot more quote-unquote wasted space, where you'd have this sliver of a home indicator in the center, and then the left and right would just be like white space. Because on the phone, you hold it primarily in portrait, and the indicator can go all the way along. On the iPad, even if you're holding it in portrait, there's no, you know, it's just a waste for having that tiny little bar stretch the entire width of the iPad screen, whether you're talking about portrait or landscape, because it's just, you know, five times bigger. It just looks ridiculous. And primarily now, the iPads you use in landscape, especially the iPad Pros, and you're just making dead space if you put an indicator on there. So I'm fairly confident that they're not going to put, you know, the little home bar indicator thing on the iPads.
Hmm.
The rounded point is more interesting. Like, the iPhone obviously rounds the corners and it looks really nice, and you have, like, the dot can cleanly trace the edge of the screen, which traces the edge of the bezel. On the iPad, the home indicator is tied into this because it provides a bottom inset of dead space, which the apps don't have to worry about, essentially. Because if you think about how a way your toolbar works and it has buttons all the way along the bottom, if you've got rounded corners, anything you put in the bottom left or the bottom right will be clipped off. And so on the phone, they just shift everything up. This is, you know, infamously why the keyboards has that blank bit, because they just ignore the clipped area, and the rectangle of the, you know, like app content just starts higher. And you fill that dead space with an indicator and, you know, the background color, essentially. And you just carry on above it.
Mm-hmm.
On the iPad, to get the rounded corner look, you're going to have the same trade-off of having to shift everything upwards. And it's probably not going to win the functionality trade-off versus how good it looks. A good comparison to me is like thinking about like the Apple Watch as a circular screen versus a rounded rectangle. Like, the circular probably is aesthetically better, but functionally you're just going to clip everything.
Yeah,
and on the iPad, if you could trace the corners of the screen, it would look nice, but I think the way the apps work, the way the apps can lay out their content, is just going to be compromised if you do clip the corners off. And if you have enough of a border that you're still, like, there's a big difference between like a 3mm border and an 8mm border in how well that tracing the edge effect looks anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's slightly bigger, I think you can more easily get away with just having a uniform rectangle. And then obviously you have the slight curve on the actual bezel that is there. But you'd essentially have what you have now, where you have like a rectangle in the device chassis, or however it looks.
Yeah,
does that make sense? It's kind of hard to explain some of this stuff in voice alone.
Yeah, I follow you. And if you look at Michael Stieber's render for 9to5 Mac, where he mocked up what basically rounded corners on the iPad at these new dimensions, 11 inches, and then you know, a smaller bezel version of the 12.9 inch iPad, you can kind of see the effect that this would create. Like, I still think I prefer it with rounded corners, and I would kind of pull for Apple to go that way if possible. But I do see what you mean about when you round it on an iPad, because of the scale, because it's so big, that a rounded corner on an iPad is a much bigger area if you need to inset content than it is on the iPhone, because like that roundness is a bigger area, and everything below it, like in between two rounded corners, needs to be kind of ignored. Then that's a big blank spot.
Imagine if you're trying to put a toolbar button in the bottom left of the screen.
Mm-hmm.
You have to shift it up and to the right by however big that radius of the corner is, which then affects, if it's in a toolbar, that means you're shifting the entire toolbar upwards. like it just encroaches on a lot more than, you know, just cutting the corner off than, yeah. Than it sounds like, I think.
Yeah, I think they could pull it off, and but you know, we'll see. But I do see what you mean about there being you know, trade-offs with that approach. And the topic of the home indicator, I could kind of see them doing it anyway, just for consistency, even with the trade-offs. But the fact is, like right now on iOS 12 beta, on all of the iPads with home buttons, you can do all of the gestures without the home indicator. And I think people are getting along just fine. Maybe they would do it for consistency. Maybe they would, I mean, just have the same language of like the home indicator. Now there's a home button. But I don't think you need it. And you have the same gestures right now that you would have otherwise. I know in our renders we didn't account for a home indicator, and that really makes you need to move content up the screen. With rounded corners, I think you could do that. You could do rounded corners and a home indicator and have a pretty good experience. I kind of would be disappointed if there were hard, you know, right angle corners like there are now, it's just a rectangle, not a rounded rectangle. Because the first thing that I when going from the iPhone 10 to the iPad, you know, for the first time, it was like, wow, those corners are really harsh. And it's just different. Like, you know, all the other screens on my life are the same way. Like the Mac is the same way. TV is the same way. And maybe it's the iPhone being so small. It's like, it's very comforting. It's very close to your face. And it's just very comforting to be rounded like that. But on the iPad, I think I'd want it to be consistent with the iPhone. So it feels like I'm going, you know, from one screen to the same like class of screen. It's tricky though, because I see the trade-offs that you're mentioning.
A good kind of like way to visualize the home indicator situation with, if you have an iPhone 10 and you go and like into like messages and you bring up the keyboard and you're in portrait, it looks okay, right? Because it has this little bar in the middle and then you've got this tiny bit of padding left and right. But then if you go into landscape, the whole keyboard's like up because the bar's still the same height, but it's the width that it takes up is just so much bigger. And that kind of effect is what you'd have on the iPad all the time, just because the screen's bigger. So yeah, you just end up with a lot more dead space mm-hmm. if you have a home indicator there on the iPad compared to the phone, which you predominantly use in portrait. So I'm interested to see what they do with the, because there's no way like the 10 plus, the bigger phone, is not going to have an indicator as well, because it just wouldn't follow the lineup.
Right.
But I think the home indicator looks problematic in landscape is just going to be a higher priority problem for people that actually use that device, as you tend to use bigger devices more in landscape. Or even now, though, people generally stay portrait on the pluses today.
Yeah, yeah. If you use Safari or messages in landscape, then you can see an example of what the home indicator is like in this in landscape mode. It is pretty, I mean, it's a pretty tight fit of what the keyboard does. And then with Safari content, like everything just kind of scrolls behind it. Now, I have felt for a long, long time that once you learn the gestures of the iPhone 10, like, I'm not convinced that you need the home indicator as much as you are. Like I love that the home screen doesn't have it. It's just the home screen is what it is. But everywhere else, it's there. And to me, it feels like, I could turn it off, you without even rearranging anything. You know, everything would be in the same spot. Just not have the line there, and I would get along just fine.
Yeah, like you could have it with the gap. You know, like so everything's still inset slightly,
mm-hmm.
and then just essentially have the bar disappear.
Yeah,
but then you might as well just have a little bar there, I think, and it gives you that consistent. Here's what I do. Because the other thing with the bar is, if you go into like the camera app, it becomes unclear sometimes where you're supposed to swipe to dismiss the camera if you didn't have a bar, if you didn't have the indicator. Because the camera app doesn't change its whole interface when you go to landscape. It just kind of rotates some of the icons.
Yeah.
So if you're in landscape, you can very clearly know that you're still swiping from that right-hand side because you swipe where the bar is. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you took the bar away, you'd then be a bit more lost about, well, I'm in landscape, but I still have to swipe from that edge. Like, I think it provides an anchor point, so people don't get, you know, super lost, and you still get most of the original iPhone appeal of, if you ever get lost, you just go home. Whereas, mm-hmm. like, if you ever get lost, you swipe up from this indicator and you're going to get back to the home screen.
Yeah. One other point is that on the 11-inch iPad, you know, the rumored 11-inch iPad, because it's a larger screen, moving content around to accommodate four rounded corners or a home indicator, I think, isn't a problem, because all in all, you're getting more space than you had on a 9.7-inch or 10.5-inch iPad. On the 12.9-inch iPad, there's a lot of room there to play with. But if you do lose space to a home indicator, then it's like you're getting this bezel-less form factor, you know, with a lighter footprint. But in service of that, you lose a little bit of screen real estate, and that's not ideal. Like, you don't want to go backwards, you know, and make a trade-off there. So because the rumor is 12.9-inch and not like 13.5 or 14-inch in the same body size as the current 12.9-inch, I think then it is maybe something that you don't want to do, is to lose any screen space to rounded corners or a home indicator. Now, I still will say, like, if I had to bet, I would expect rounded corners and a home indicator for consistency. The only other factor there is LCDs displays versus OLED displays, because on the iPhone, it's an OLED display. And I think that plays into what they can do. Whereas the LCD, I don't know if it's tricky. They're going to do it based on rumors for the middle-sized iPhone this year, and the bezel size. You know, you can have larger bezels on the iPad, so maybe it's not a problem. But
yeah, I mean, we've already seen the 6.1-inch iPhone has the same gen. It's close to the OLED screens in terms of how big the bezel is, but it's still like, you know, another 1.5 millimeter on the end, yeah, because it's LCD. Like, because they just can't quite stretch it as much as they can with the OLED screens. Again, with the iPad, that's kind of an immaterial difference, because we're expecting the bezel to be, you know, in the 8-9 millimeter range rather than the 3-4 millimeter range anyway. So
yeah, so it's like if you didn't care about ergonomics of like holding the iPad with hands, you know, and thumbs, and you had an OLED iPad, then you could have maybe an even thinner bezel, and then you might require a notch, because I'm still very much in the camp of not thinking that we're going to need a notch on the iPad. I hear other people talk, and other people think it's like a given, and especially because of the changes in iOS 12 where they move the status bar stuff around and make room for a notch. I really feel strongly that you can have a uniform bezel and include all the sensors within that bezel and have no notch. Like, and because the iPad's bigger, it's proportional and it looks really sleek. Like, these renders, it can fit in that, and these renders look futuristic to me. So
yeah, like, just take the height of the notch on the iPhone and imagine that as all four sides of an iPad. Like, you don't need a notch on the iPad to pull this off, because you're not going to the 2-3 millimeter range on the other sides. You're going for a more uniform, you know, like 8 millimeter kind of range.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The other big question that's not necessarily software, but kind of, is where are they going to put the Face ID camera? Because for a start, there's no evidence yet that it's going to work in multiple orientations, though it would be weird if it didn't. But even if you assume it does work in more than, like, you hold the iPad, if you put it on the like the left and the right side in landscape, which is where the camera is now, you kind of hold the iPad when you unlock it. So you're kind of going to cover the camera.
Yeah, I would not mind if the iPad, if Apple acknowledged that the iPad is often used in landscape mode, especially the 12.9-inch model. Like, that should not be a portrait orientation default. Like, with the Apple logo, it needs to rotate. You know, acknowledge that we use these, like, this more keyboard forces it in that orientation, and then the Apple logo is sideways. Like, that is not attractive to me. So I wouldn't mind if the iPad, you know, physically changed its default orientation to be landscape and had the sensors in the middle of that screen. Then you've got top and bottoms to ignore if you're holding it in portrait, kind of. But if it's where the camera is now, on the side, then you're right that is an area where it's your hands do go. And it's just the fact that we use iPads in that orientation, especially the big iPads, and if they don't change that, then it would be an issue there if your hand covers it up, because it's the perfect, like, holding spot is where the camera's at. Except right now, it's not as much of an issue because it's a little bit lower because of the big thick bezel. But if it gets, you know, as thin as possible, the bezel, then that location is like a grab bar, basically, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, as it is now, like, obviously you have the button that your hand covers, but you know it's a button, so you still click it, and then you can just move your thumb away.
Right.
Whereas with the camera, I think your brain kind of, like, forgets where you know where this is actually coming from in the scheme of things. So if they do just put it on the side and there's no, like, compensation for it, you're just going to sit there with the iPad and gripping it with the left and right hand, and it's going to cover the camera over, and then it's going to say, I can't unlock you. Like, I just think it's fascinating to consider, like, the different ergonomic challenges that the iPad form factor has at doing this, you know, bezel-less Face ID thing versus the phone.
Mm-hmm.
You have upside down, front side up. Because the Apple really banks on the fact with a phone is that you're not holding it upside down, so you never end up covering that notch area with your hand.
Yeah.
Because you have to turn it upside down to even work. Whereas on the iPad, it's going to be, there's no way they're not going to make it work upside down, at least, because, you know, you can, the classic iPad line, it adapts to whatever way you hold it, blah, blah,
right,
blah.
Right, yeah. So there's my ideal iPad Pro, is that the corners are rounded, no home indicator, although I would stomach it, and then having the main orientation be landscape, acknowledged by the Apple logo in the back rotating, and the sensors, the camera, and all being on one of the side bezels, which would become the top bezel would then be one of the wider ones and not the narrower ones. I would love that. If you could put the iPad in a smart keyboard case and have the Apple logo look correct, that'd be a big win. All right, let's talk about some photo stuff for the rest of the show. There's a lot of new stuff in iOS 12 with photos that doesn't, you know, it gets stage time, but we haven't discussed it a whole lot, you know, yet. So the first thing is the way that photo sharing works. So you still have the problem, Mayo, of, you know, if you want to have a family photo library, you can't just have, like, one. You need to deal with some moving things around to get photos there. You can't just you can't do, like, shared albums that automatically work like that. You've got to set all that stuff up. But Apple is getting a lot better at acknowledging that people are in photos and that you might want to send those photos to them. They kind of nudge you to say, hey, you were this person was in this photo with you. Do you want to send them this photo? And you can tap a button and then send it off to them. And the way that that works is different now than it used to. It used to be an iCloud photo sharing album that you would set up, and it was permanent, and it lasted until you took it away, and the photos were downsized. And now it's, how does it work now? It's different.
Yeah, so the two options you had before was create, you know, the shared, like, permanent, never until you delete your album. You invite your friends, and it's kind of like a photo stream, but shared. That's where it came from. It was originally shared photo streams. Or you'd message them to your friend, and you just send 20 attachments, and they save them all, which is
one by one, yeah.
Yeah, one by one.
You could airdrop if you're in person, but then you've got to still be in person.
So. Yeah. They've dramatically improved this in 12 by you don't have to use a suggestion. You can just pick any, you know, I think it's like three or more pictures, and then you share them, you press messages, and what it sends is like this iMessage app bubble that says sent via iCloud, and it's like a little preview of an album, and it's ad hoc. Like, if you can share that today's album if you want, or you can just pick, you know, like 10 random pictures, and it'll just date it,
yeah,
7 days ago to today or whatever. And you're basically underneath it all, you're sharing a link, because you can actually get a URL for this if you want to, like, tweet it or whatever. You don't have to go through messages, which is interesting. But then it sends them this album that they can open in line inside of messages on their own device, and there's one big blue button that just says save all, and you can save all the pictures. Mm-hmm. Or you can tap and choose the ones that you want to keep. And so you go from saving 20 individual attachments to pressing one button. The bigger difference here is if you have iCloud Photo Library turned on, and you have optimized storage turned on, and you want to share, let's say, 10 photos that aren't locally cached, on iOS 11 and prior, you would select those 10 pictures, you'd go to the share sheet to press message. It would then come up with a loading spinner because it has to download these 10 pictures into memory from iCloud Photo Library.
And it's not fast for whatever reason. It's not been fast for me to download.
Yeah, iCloud Photo Library, it's not awful, but it doesn't feel as zippy. It doesn't feel like it's saturating my broadband. I'll give it that. Yeah. Like, so you have to wait a minute for it to download these 10 pictures at full quality, for it to put it inside the messages, you know, bubble transcript so you can send it off. But then when you press send all messages, it then has to upload the 10 photos it just downloaded so it can send them off in the message, which then takes another however long. And then your friend on the other end then has to download them as well.
Yeah.
So now, with this new, essentially, like, sharing a link system, you can make the album without ever having to download the pictures from iCloud Photo Library. And when you message, you're not uploading the pictures into the chat transcript. You're just sending a link.
Yeah, that's way more intelligent.
All of those loading spinners just go away.
Yeah.
So thumbs up so far.
Yeah, I love that. I don't have, you know, for one, it's way more efficient and thought out in terms of how you don't have to wait for it to become local on your device to send it to somebody else. When they start out in the cloud, they should be able to connect that way, and now they will. And then I for a while I was very good about creating shared photo streams, naming them like, here's a shared photo stream album, here's what it's called, and invite everyone that's involved in the photos, and then send them, because then they get an alert on their iPhone, their Photos app says like, Zach has shared a photo stream with you, do you want to accept it, you add it. But then to them, like, they have the photos and they don't go the extra step, because there's no reason that they would, without knowing that they needed to go and select all and save to their library, because
at lower quality as well.
Yeah, at a lower quality.
Like, the trade-off with the new system is that it's full resolution, but the albums only stick around for 30 days.
Yeah, which is so, like, iCloud drop.
Yeah, so they do expire, but I almost think that's kind of like better, because you don't have to have like a permanent shared album with someone. Like,
yeah,
if you just have a party and you want to share these pictures with your five friends, you don't really want to make a shared photo album just for that situation. You just want to, you know, you're basically just doing like an email and you're just sending a bunch of pictures, and then you're kind of done, and you can leave it around for a month and they can go and save them locally if they want to, or they just look at them, have, you know, enjoy it and then leave it, and then it just all expires and goes away. And inside of the Photos app, you can see like your recently shared albums, both the photo streams, like permanent ones, and the, you know, ephemeral ones that just kind of stick around temporarily if you want to quickly go back in and then quickly share it to someone else as well. So that kind of whole flow's pretty well done.
Because it was part of my routine to go through and see like, oh, this is from a year ago. Surely they've downloaded it by now, or they, I hope so. Or I just don't want it on my list anymore, because I have them in my library. I don't want to be the permanent source for their library. So I would just remove it. And then it's on me. Like, why did you take away my photo? It's just like, ah. So I'm so glad that there's a much better system now, starting with iOS 12. And the fact that it's one tap to download all the photos and not you know, a longer method to get there. Now, the thing that I've had an issue with, and I tweeted about this recently, is the sharing suggestions. So from what I've seen, they do a pretty good job of seeing, like, this is an event, like a holiday, and grouping photos that way, recognizing contacts. You know, you've got someone in your contacts list, and they've got a name and a face in your photos library. You've named them before. You've made that connection of, this is a person in my contact. This is their name. They're in this photo. From now on, you know, find all the pictures of that person and group them together, so I can find them easily later. Do a pretty good job of that. But as a parent, I take a lot of pictures of my kids, and so most of my sharing suggestions are photos of my baby who's 11 months old, and then, you know, 10 items, and then share with Rory. Like, it wants me to message him pictures of himself, and that isn't ideal, and it's kind of like making my sharing suggestions populated with things that I'm never going to act on. Like, I've got a few of my dad in here. Those are more useful. A few of my mom. But most of these are pictures of my kids that it's suggesting I send to my kids. And maybe at some point that's useful, but like, my kids are 11 months old and 5 years old, and neither of them would know what to do if I messaged them a bunch of pictures of themselves this way. And, you know, further down in the For You section on photos, I can see, or over in search, actually, I can see people and categories, and one includes babies. And so the app is smart enough to know that these are kids, these are babies, just by looking at them. And I think it should be smart enough to rule out sharing pictures of babies with babies. And right now it's not. So What I would like to see is you can kind of make relationships. So you can have a contact card for your kids, you know, with their name and birthday, and you can even say relationships, related people, and you can, you know, designate what the relationship is. So I can put his mom and say this is mother. And what I would like to see is if I take a picture of him, you know, a bunch at an event, who would like to share it with is his mom, not him. And so here are 10 pictures from my birthday party of my son. And what you know, sending them to him doesn't make any sense, but sending them to his mom does. And you can easily kind of like convert the suggestion, you know, you don't have to send it to the person it's suggested for, but in spirit of it being more automated, I think it ought to consider things like that's a baby, that's a kid, and this is their parent, your partner or otherwise, send it to that person and not the child itself. So
yeah, like it's not useless because it's still technically making a group of the birthday that you can then, you know, it's one less tap to select all those pictures to then share it to your wife or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's still kind of like, this seems a bit dumb.
Yeah, as I tweeted,
I can see, say if you've got like a 5-year-old, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of cool to be able to share the picture to them and then they can see them themselves. But at the very minimum, it should suggest to share with the young child and their parent.
Yeah, like, I'm not sure what the age cutoff should be. Like, my 5-year-old, I guess she would appreciate it if I, like, messaged her. She's an iPod Touch that she can message on and access to an iPad. It's like, I guess so. Like, she takes pictures. And the other day, she airdropped me a photo that she had just taken of me because, like, I guess she hit share and then saw my picture and tapped it. And then, you know, whether she knew it or not, she was airdropping and I accepted it. I'm not sure what the age is. Maybe, like, 8, 10, I don't know, like, and how it would even guess. But I think if it knows babies versus, like, kids, then babies should not be recommended. The parents should be, or other family or something, you know, but not the babies themselves. And I tweeted it out, and it was a pretty good way of finding out, like, who has babies, because everyone on iOS 12 beta that follows me with babies was like, yeah, me too. It's every suggestion. And it's like, at that age, you know, you take a lot of pictures because every month is different. It's like, you know, so.
Yeah, and the other way that Apple could solve this, which they're not doing at the moment, is like a machine learning approach where if you always take, you know, these 20, if you always take a sharing suggestion of Rory, mm-hmm. and change it to send it to his mum instead,
yep.
then over time it would learn and suggest mum instead of Rory. Like, mm-hmm. there's different avenues they could do this. Like the editing the contact card and a relationship for mother is like probably the most clear-cut way of doing it, but in reality very few people are actually going to go to that trouble. So you kind of want something that's more hands-off and like,
yeah,
oh, it can just learn over time that pictures of this person can be shared with this person, like, almost every time.
Yeah, I can just see it. Dad, why did you send me all these pictures of myself when I was that age 10 years ago? Like, so, and I mean, plus the fact that they only last for 30 days, it's not very practical. And I do have like account set up for my kids and family sharing, just primarily so that they can have an email address that's not, you know, when all the good ones are taken, like have their names at me.iCloud.com. But really it can be like any contact. It doesn't have to be in family sharing, it can be any contact. So I think the solution would be then, like, if I didn't have a name for my kids in my contacts or in the photos, then I wouldn't have the suggestions. But then if I do something like I want to put together, you know, a photo project and look for all the pictures of my kids, then I wouldn't be able to do that. So not worth the trade-off there. The other thing you had an issue with a funny suggestion of a really poor photo being called best photo. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
Tell me about that.
It was like, I was just messing around with the, because iOS 12 adds a new algorithm for portrait lighting where they do a better job of masking out the person. So theoretically, there's less bad portrait lighting shots. So I was messing around with that and I just took one and forgot to delete it. And it was a stage lighting effect, which are always the worst. And even on 12, it was still pretty bad. It had a pretty bad crop of around my shirt and stuff. Like, you could see the background and then there's just plain black. And it wasn't a great... It wasn't the most flattering picture of me anyway. But they have this thing in the For You tab where they try and highlight like featured photos.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, I scrolled down and there was this terrible picture of me with this terrible portrait lighting crop, with this portrait lighting crop. And then it just had a little label, best photo.
In all caps, right? Like,
right
best
in the
photo.
Corner. I was like,
It was like arguably possibly the worst photo you could take.
Yeah, it needed like a terrible award, not a great photo commendation on it. So that was kind of funny. I assume that they just kind of like flag up portrait lighting pictures because they assume they're going to be good. Like,
yeah.
Rather, because realistically, the Apple AI does not have human levels of intelligence when it comes to working out whether this is really a good photo or not. So I assume the algorithm prioritizes like faces. And then, like, portrait lighting shots and things like that.
Yeah. And is it true that in iOS 12 beta 4 that label is gone now?
The label is gone. It still recommends the picture to me.
Yeah, because I'm in my For You section. And if I scroll down below sharing suggestions, below memories, and then below recently shared, I can see featured photos. And there are three there. And one is pretty good. It's my dad and my son. And I've already applied an effect to it, which is like the bounce leap effect. And it looks really good because kids move a lot and you can see it in the photo. One is another picture of my kid I took, and it's like got the location and the date. It's a good picture. And then the middle one is the iOS 7 background I downloaded like to be able to use on my iPad. It's like, okay, why is that featured? I like
pretty random.
I like below that I have effect suggestions and It's my mom, and then it says portrait, and it says apply studio lighting to this portrait mode photo. I tapped it, and it crashed the app, so that's the beta for you. But, yeah, every time I tap it, it crashes photos. Like, maybe you tap it, and it just applies it and shows you, or maybe it's previewing that for me already. I have another one that says make this a live photo a loop. So those are my two effect suggestions. The loop one, I can see that it's applied it already, so it must be true of the portrait one as well. So it's just that tapping them crashes the Photos app. But
yeah, and obviously you can find the like the bad examples where it's like great photo and it's terrible. But in general, I'm actually like pretty impressed with this new For You tab. Like it takes what before was just memories and adds you know a lot more context and different ideas around it and things like those little effects. You know, the average person doesn't even know they exist, so. If the operating system can like surface that for them up front, they can actually see it and you know benefit from stuff that they'd realistically never find themselves.
Yeah, and then in the next, you've got in the notes the section is called "Photo Search is So Weird Now." I'm not sure I take that. I know where you're coming from on that because I'm on my iPad looking at Photo Search, and I love how this looks. Like I've got moments at the top where it showed me a year ago, summer trips, restaurants, birthdays, concerts, nights out, museum visits, and weddings. And I've got people, which is all the people I've named. And I love these little pictures. Places with their location and the map snippet. And then categories, which has both animals, cats, and dogs, which is weird. But then like underwater, aquariums, cars, fireworks. And then the last one is groups with like combinations of faces together. Why do you think that Photos search is so weird now?
Right. I should have probably clarified. That view before you type anything in is fine.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
My specific problem is a big feature of the photo search in iOS 12 is that you're allowed to search for multiple terms.
Okay.
So this includes like the objects and the people and stuff, right? And the stupid thing, though, is you can't just type in two things separated by a space. It doesn't work. Like, I've readied an example. I know there's a picture of a cupcake that's got a fruit on it, and it's tagged as a fruit and it's tagged as a berry. But if you just type in the search field fruit space berry, it will come up with no results.
Yeah, if I type in cats, I get cats, and if I type in cat space, I get no results.
Right,
space
but
kills it.
If you type cat,
yeah,
and then before you press search, you tap one of those little suggested searches where it gives you the the options in the top, and that will make like a tag in the search field. It'll outline it in gray, so it's very clearly like a token in the field. Then you can type in another query and it will join the two together.
Okay, so I'm gonna search for cat and National Cat Day and then Florida, All right, there were 18 photos on National Cat Day in Florida. That's pretty good.
Yeah, but if you just typed National Cat Day space Florida, it would come up with nothing.
Yeah, no good.
So, like, it just goes against how everyone knows how to search with Google, right? You don't have to type a term, then tap it, and then type another term, and then tap it.
You just keyword bang the keyboard.
Yeah, and it's like Spotlight on iOS does the same thing, right? You don't have to tokenize every separate thing. You just type it with some spaces in between, and it'll find it.
Did they? Was that a feature in Mail one year, and they call it like bouillon? I don't know. There's a term for it, but it was basically that, like, you natural language search and
yeah, natural. That's on the Mac.
Yeah.
So you can type in like a natural language, like find emails from Zach that I haven't read, and it'll do a pretty good job of finding them all.
So it parses what you said as different search tokens, like Zach unread, basically.
Yeah, but it's doing it humanely. Like,
yeah. Whereas this isn't doing it at all yet.
This is like exposing the back end of the search service. Like, this photo is tagged with this, and it's tagged with this, but that shouldn't show in the user-facing UI. Like, people just aren't going to find it.
Yeah.
Like, the obvious way for it to work, it just doesn't do it.
Yeah, and this is shipping, by the way. Like, this is how it's designed to work. It's not that they haven't polished it yet.
Yeah, like, the number of changes that we'll see from the current beta 4 to shipping in terms of, you know, like, UI interface changes would be very, very minimal.
Yeah.
Like, it's so late in this, it's late enough in the cycle now that, you know, Apple's basically just on bug fixes only.
Yeah, yeah. We've seen that from recent betas, you know, especially. Okay, so that's weird sort of photo search on iOS. On the Mac, I've got a few complaints. And I want to start this out by saying, I was a pretty big fan of iPhoto. I started to notice it go downhill because it was getting slower the larger my photo library got. And the more you use it, the worse it got because of that. And it got where it was like unbearable to use just because of the speed alone. And it would crash, and it was less reliable for something that needed to be like super reliable. So then Photos came along, Photos for Mac. And it looked kind of like the iOS version, but on the Mac. And it had, for me, dramatic speed improvements, and there was new features like iCloud Photo Library, where you can have all of your photos be in sync between iOS and the Mac, including albums, including edits, and ones that you delete. It was a humongous improvement for me, so I was a humongous fan of Photos for Mac, and still am. But that 1.0 version, I think, was my favorite, because then they slowly started addressing like user complaints, and they added a sidebar as an option. Wasn't the default yet, and then I think it became the default eventually in place of like toolbars at the top of the screen. And then I think last year they made the toolbar the only option. It wasn't an option, it was what you get, to make it more Mac like but to me, I didn't prefer it, because it's like too much information when I only want to see this one view, and then I lose, you know, the app has to be wider to see the same amount of photos. So I wasn't in favor of that. This year, there's two changes that further set me back from like my love of 1.0 version of Photos. The first one is the keyboard shortcuts have changed. So before, I've tweeted about this, that the space bar when you select a photo would open and close the photo, just like Quick Look on Finder. It brings up the photo, it closes the photo. You know, it gives you the preview, closes it. I liked that a lot. It's like muscle memory. They changed it to space bar is like play, which I guess like if you're, you know, a big iTunes user or you work with media, I guess like video, it makes sense. But to me, like, I just don't make the connection. Like, spacebar is like page down on Safari, and then in Photos it was like open and close. Well, if you have a live photo, spacebar plays it. If you have a video, it plays it. But if it's just a regular photo with no effect on it or video, then you just get a dud sound. So you need to do option space to kind of keep that same routine. The new way to do it is return. Return opens and closes. And return used to be edit. So they've changed that for some reason. And I'm not crazy about it at all. And I think that's sticking around. That's going to ship. And then they removed the print product services. So this was part of iPhoto. They moved it into Photos, and I was so glad to see it there, that where you can do projects where you use your photos, and like you have the benefit of having every photo you've ever taken, and you've organized it because you care about your photo library, and it's time to do something with it. You want to put together a calendar for the holidays, or a photo book, like a physical photo book of your pictures, or even just like a basic card, you know, for the holidays or something. And you could do things like use your faces and like find people and do search things like at this time, and it was really nice. Well, last year they added extensions where you could not only use Apple's print services, you could use Mac App Store apps so that you build a project in Photos, but then you order it through another service. It's like, ah, oh, cool, more options. Well, this year, that's the only way to do it because they're taking it away. It's like, oh no. It's like my beloved Photos app is slowly changing into like not something I love as much. It's like not great. So every year at Christmas, I would make it was like guaranteed for grandparents. They were going to get a calendar. I mean, they still will, I guess. I'll just have to find another service. And I'm not crazy about that. And I think I even mentioned on an episode, I hope they don't remove that. because it's cool to have the option, but I don't want it to be like the only way to get these third party apps.
Yeah. When they added the third party extensions in High Sierra, I started to get a bit nervous about it because it never came. Apple's print service never came to iOS.
Yeah.
And that, if it's not on iOS, it's on the chopping block at some point.
Like, yeah. And there was the Cards app that Steve Jobs had introduced, or was forced to introduce somebody.
Forced to.
Like iOS 5 or so. And it went away with iOS 7. Like, they just discontinued it. They didn't like redesign it. They just said, we recommend using iPhoto at the time on the Mac. And that was such a cool app because you could take a great photo on your iPhone, use the Cards app to design like a quality letterpress card with the photo. And there were different designs for like different times of the year. And then you could, you know, like you order it on your iPhone and it came through the mail in a really cool envelope that's like from, you know, labeled from Apple to that person. And it's so neat because it's like, you know, real. And I ordered so many of those. And one of the things I would do as like a joke thing was like, see with friends, how inappropriate the picture could be and still have it printed. And it's just like, you know, here's a friend of mine. It's like, I got a card for you. Okay, be careful opening that. And it's like, it's like just mixing like something really polished with like, you know, a gag picture or something. But on the Mac, like print services were always something very serious for me. It was like holidays come up. This is an easy and sentimental thing to do. And I'll still do that, like I said, but I won't be using Apple's print photo services, which are probably like premium priced for quality, but, you know, not really worth it products. And I've had a decent experience using Walgreens print services and picking them up in store, like for posters and stuff like that for around the house. But that's using their website and not the Photos app. And there's a handful of apps that will integrate with Photos, but I'm not in love with any of them. And I don't have any opinion of any of them yet, except that they're not what I used to use.
Yeah, I think it's pretty bad now that you go to start a project in Photos and all you get is an option to go to the App Store to find to find an app that could provide a project UI. Like, I wish they'd kind of like endorse, you know, like have one built in. Like, it's hard because it's always about like Apple saying no to things and Apple streamlining themselves, and you can kind of see why the same company that doesn't want to sell phones with headphone jacks doesn't want to parade around selling printed out pictures. Like, you know, this is the modern era of digital photography. So it is hard, but at the same time, it's like, you know, if you really didn't believe in having a photo printing service, you probably like rip out projects from the Photos app altogether.
Yeah, you wouldn't punt the third parties to do
that. Yeah, like, because a third party app could just import from the photo library and do basically the same thing.
Sure, yeah.
Like, it just wouldn't be in, you know, the Photos menu. So it does kind of feel a bit like Apple trying to get the best of both worlds and really getting neither.
Yeah, and
it's kind of sad.
Yeah, the way it looks on High Sierra is you can reorder projects that you've already created through the end of September. And on Mojave, you can't. You just, you can't even do that, I guess. I didn't have that ability. It just punts you to the app to the Mac App Store. So RIP photo projects. And to me, it's like the worrisome slow decline. Like I'm almost going to be to the point where I don't know, but maybe like a Marzipan version of even though it's already close because it was like UXKit, like before the Marzipan stuff happened, where they made like a version of Photos for the Mac that's kind of like the iOS version. Maybe the Photos app on the iPad gets so good that I just want them to Marzipan it over and have that be on the Mac instead.
And they did add a more Mac-like importing screen now on iOS 12 on the iPad. Like if you import pictures from the SD card or a connected camera, it looks a lot more like the Photos Mac, you know, experience.
Yeah.
So they're kind of converging different ways, although I always think the sidebar example is funny. Like on the Mac now, the sidebar is forced. And usually Apple loves to put a sidebar on an iPad app. But Photos, no sidebar, just full screen, iPhone stretched out.
Yeah, they're waiting to Marzipan that before they give you the sidebar on the iPad. So, all right.
Yeah. Despite all these criticisms, I'm still relatively happy with Photos and our photo library. Like, I never have data loss. I never have problems like that. Syncing is slow, but it's okay. But it just feels like the UI clients are taking a bit of a downturn in the recent years.
Yeah, and I think it's a response to feedback, and it's like maybe go with what you think the first time because some of us like that better. So, all right, you enjoy your UK light switches, and I'm going to continue my vacation and take more photos that I can't print out anymore. Yeah. In the meantime, you can give us feedback at happyhour@netifymac.com. You can follow me and my beautiful photos on Instagram at @apollozach or on Twitter at @apollozach. And Benjamin, you are.
You can follow me on Twitter at @BZAMayo.
All right. And we'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Until then, bye, everybody.